Rent Control and Measure U have been in the spotlight at City Hall this week, with Sacramento's Mayor Daryl Steinberg making his case for both. On Insight, some context and detail about the debates from CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffitt. He talked with the mayor and Craig Powell, who opposes Measure U. Butterfly researcher Dr. Art Shapiro is giving a public lecture next week about his 45 years of study. He'll join us today with that and how the past few years of rain have changed the monarch count. We'll meet artist and photographer Melissa Uroff. She's opening a solo show at Wall Public Market in Sacramento tomorrow. And the bluegrass folk music of Nell Robinson and Jim Nunnally. We'll hear their music before they play the Harris Center tomorrow night. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Measure U is a decision that voters in Sacramento will see on the November ballot. It would double what is now a temporary sales tax in the city, and Measure U would make that tax permanent. Mayor Daryl Steinberg and the city's fiscal watchdog Craig Powell are at odds over Measure U. Meanwhile, the mayor and city council members are discussing another issue, and that is rent control, with differing views on that issue. And all of these conversations indicate not only the housing crisis in the state, but efforts to tackle the problem, which are happening at the local level and the statewide level. The debates in Sacramento are not unlike debates happening in other California cities, and there will be a statewide rent control initiative on the November ballot. That is Prop 10, and you can find an explanation of it on our website at capradio.org. CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffitt is in the studio with me. He has talked this week to the mayor, sat through many, many meetings, talked with Craig Powell, city council members, and I'm glad you're here, Bob, so we can get not only some history, some context, but kind of a mapping of the issues.
Good morning.
So let's start with Measure U. A little bit of history. When was it originally passed, and what's it done for the city since then?
2012 took effect in 2013. It's averaged between $40 and $47 million a year every full fiscal year since. And it was passed because due to the Great Recession, we had a lot of cuts. We had cuts to police. We had cuts to fire. Pools were closed. Libraries were closed. Parks did not have maintenance. And so the city council went to the people of Sacramento and said, if you approve this temporary half-cent sales tax, then we can restore all of these items until we're back on financial footing, which I think everybody would agree we're back on financial footing. But now that we have this cash cow coming in, it was more money than they expected. So now we have more money than we expected. Mm. And now the city says, well, we'd like to continue that. And not only that, but we'd like to double down on it and actually increase it by more to pay for what the mayor likes to call inclusive economic revitalization, or so there are a lot of big words in there that he throws out.
He has to be careful about specifying what this money will be spent on. That's kind of a side issue here. But essentially, his pitch to the city in wanting this change, extension and expansion of Measure U, is to say what? To say what about this growing city?
You know, he wants to include the corridors like Stockton Boulevard and Del Paso and Franklin, and he wants them included in the economic revitalization. He says it's not happening. But to your point, your earlier point, he can't say exactly what he would like to use the money for because it's a general tax. So this is supposed to go into the general fund, and then the good people of Sacramento have to kind of take him at his word that he's going to use the money for what it's going to be used for. But the opposition says, without a guarantee, we think it's just going to go towards pensions.
And how much more projected money is it?
Another $50 million. I mean, it would double the existing sales tax, which has been between $40 and $47 million. So you double that and between $80 and $94 million. But they're rounding up now to $50 or to $100.
So you talked to the mayor a lot. Why don't you take us into part of your conversation with him?
Well, I asked him about a lot, some of the fiscal aspects of the city budget, and the pension obligations was one thing that I was thinking about. But then I really the first thing I just asked him was, what is this going to do?
This city is so exciting. There are so many great things going on, but we need more capital to invest in job creation, to deal with our affordable housing crisis, including homelessness, and to invest in youth, and to grow this city in a way that extends the benefits of that growth to our neighborhoods and to the communities that have long been left out.
This is a place where the mayor speaks passionately and people listen, and he's enjoying a high confidence level in the city. However, that said, people thinking through what he wants to do definitely have some questions, and there's some resistance.
Well, yeah, and there has been a committee was formed last week called No One Major U. Craig Powell, who is better known for running the Ion Sacramento watchdog group and putting out papers, has come out as the leader of that group, which is about 24 people so far, according to him. And they're saying that there are a couple, several things wrong with increasing the tax, not only the primary one being that it's a regressive tax.
It's pretty clear what it will do to the residents and businesses of Sacramento. It will impose the highest sales tax of the entire region on the residents who have the lowest per capita income of the region, which is pretty obvious to recognize as the height of unfairness.
So the mayor isn't arguing that the sales tax is regressive. What does he say about some of what Craig Powell's argument is?
Well, he says the extra money needs to be used primarily for housing. That's basically, he says housing is basically the starter of all things of the economic revitalization for these areas.
And that's where this ties into the rent control discussion that's going on in the city and the homeless problem discussion and a number of others. But just to stay for a moment on Measure U, Craig Powell is looking back at past history, too, and saying, look at the city's track record.
Well,
does he think the city broke its promise?
Yeah, absolutely, because the city council and, the mayor wasn't on the city council at the time, but the city council did say this is a temporary sales tax until we get back on our feet. And now we're back on our feet and they're saying, well, it's done such a great job. We'd really like to do this. And now that we've proven that that you can trust us by us using the money for what we said we were going to use it for, kick down another half-cent sales tax, and then we'll do even more good things.
Which it's true, Bob, that this is an argument at the beginning of any proposed tax increase. The opposition will say, no, we're going to get used to the money coming in. We're going to get so accustomed to this that we aren't going to want to end this tax, and people will get accustomed to paying it. And that's part of Craig Powell's point.
Well, and that was part of the council discussions for the last couple of years, was they knew that this was going to end. And there was some discussion as to whether they should start tapering down the expenditures and then start increasing the city expenditures in order to pick up the slack. But then those that wanted to just increase, wanted to keep the tax, said, no, we promised that we were going to use it all. And then we should use it all. And then there will just be a cliff. And then we'll just fall over it at the end. But we're just going to, and then It was pretty easy to see that really the end game there was that they had made up their mind that they were just going to keep spending the money that they had and then hope the voters would continue that and make things easier on them.
So you said the word pension a little earlier. Let's wrap back around to that point and the issue of whether some of this Measure U money would go to the pension liability. And let's start with Craig Powell's position.
Well, the pension liability is increasing exponentially every year. There's, I think, 28, and then it's going to end up being somewhere around 62 or 64 million within a couple of years. And it's a huge problem. And Powell says that this money is going to end up just going there.
If all of the things being the same, that $50 million gets vacuumed up, it gets put into the general fund because there's no legal requirement on how it's spent. It gets put into the general fund and then vacuumed up to pay the legal bills of the city first and foremost before it does any discretionary spending like these various projects that the mayor has in mind.
It's interesting that he uses the phrase vacuumed up, because the image is just, you know, the dollars just getting sucked away and sucked out of the general fund, which is exactly what he wants to say.
Well, yeah, and that's you could make the argument that the money would come from the general fund, it would come from a different part of the general fund, but that's the whole thing about the general fund is all the money goes in and then it's up to the council to decide how much comes out and where it goes. And so it's, you know, if that is the case and if the city does end up having to, you know, pay off the $68 million or whatever it is, using general fund money, and there isn't additional increased revenue from other sources, then yeah, that could happen. But, you know, we don't know. The economic recovery has been better than we thought. The existing tax revenue has been better than we thought. You know, the argument could be made that maybe things will be better than we thought. But he's saying we can't guess that's going to happen. We have to look at what the numbers are and plan for the worst and hope for the best.
Meanwhile, let's get back to what the mayor says about this. A mayor who has stood for the issues of homelessness and with that mental health and housing. And he is saying in every way that he knows to reassure people, short of designating the money, that this money is going to help with housing. In fact, what, at the top of his list is housing?
Yeah, the top of it's not all going to go to housing, but that's certainly the priority. And he's made it the priority even before the Measure U discussion began. But, you know, he paints a pretty clear picture with the amount of money that's in the Housing Trust Fund now compared to what could be available if Measure U passes.
We have $2.5 million in our Housing Trust Fund, enough to subsidize 15 units of affordable housing. And we have 47,000 people in this city of low to modest income that are paying 30% or more of their limited income on rent. We have a housing crisis and we have a homelessness crisis as well that we're addressing aggressively. But we want the ability to bring to scale that which we have started and where we are demonstrating success.
I'm not sure anyone doubts whether some of this money would go in the direction that he's saying, but did you ask him specifically about the point of pension liability and the pension fund?
The answer was something along the lines of, yes, that's a problem. And we have to, and the primary solution was cost savings, was look at the budget, look at what we're spending money on now, and come up with significant cost savings in order to come up with the money to take care of that, which really is where he and Craig Powell agree, only the mayor didn't have a concrete plan when I spoke to him, and Powell does with quite a few specific ideas proposed, including that the city employees pay half of their pension. And that retiree health benefits are cut. And he said that's not going to he doesn't think that's going to happen because he doesn't think the city council has the political will to take on the unions. There are other savings as well from officers who graduate the police academy, paying back the cost of that academy if they leave the city employment within 5 years. Other things like that, that they say could add up to $125 million in savings. The mayor says there are savings to be had, but he did not have the specifics.
All right. Measure U, which we are talking about, will be on the November ballot in Sacramento for voters to decide. There's much more about it on our website. I'm talking with CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffitt, and Measure U definitely ties in with housing. So let's talk about rent control, because that debate was center stage earlier this week at the city council meeting. And the mayor and city council members are similar but different on this issue.
Yeah, the council members Jennings and Guerra and Hansen came out with a plan that the basic components were 18-month leases should be offered That should be mandatory. And that mediation should be available to anyone who is looking at a rent increase of more than 6%. And so those are the two. Those are two of the main components of their plan. The mayor came out as they were coming out, as those council members coming out. He came out with his own plan, which in many ways was similar. I think they had both been reviewing the same research because a lot of the data points were essentially the same. And the gist was that for larger units, more than six, that those rental properties should stretch out the lengths of the leases, that there should be a cap on the annual increase for rates, trying to keep the tide of rental increases from skyrocketing, which is what they have been doing.
I think we are going to hear from one of the council members who was part of that initial plan from the council.
Yeah, Rick Jennings, one of his, main tenets was, no pun intended, was that there should be a longer time in between basically contract negotiations as when you're signing your lease, just to give families more of an idea of how much they're going to pay.
And they don't have to be concerned about budgeting or rent going up during that 18-month period of time or being displaced from their home. Their kids being displaced from their home and their schools and the community that they've, grown up in and love.
So he's making the pitch for these 18-month leases. There are more details in both the mayor's plan and the city council. So, Bob, we have a statewide rent control initiative that will be on the November ballot for the statewide approach. In this case, the city council itself will vote on the decision about rent control?
Not until the Proposition 10 issue is settled.
Okay.
And that will make things clearer as far as what the city of Sacramento can or can't do. There are a lot of exemptions in the state law when it comes to the rent control issue, and a lot of those would disappear or appear. It's pretty wonky as to, what the details are of the state law. And so when that is all settled, then the city can come in and then they can make a decision based on what the new state law is. But the mayor said he's not going to bring this forward before the election.
All right. We're going to be seeing more of you in the studio. Let's just say it that way.
Probably, yeah.
Thanks a lot for all the background and for coming in today.
Oh, sure.
That is CAP Radio reporter Bob Moffitt. And again, coverage of these issues and the developments this week are at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The study of butterflies, especially monarchs, gives us both clues and mysteries. UC Davis professor Dr. Art Shapiro has been observing and collecting data on California butterflies for more than 45 years. He's sharing some of that work in another one of his informative free public lectures. It's coming up this Tuesday, September 11th at the Sierra College Nevada County campus, which is in Grass Valley. And Dr. Shapiro is on the phone right now from Davis. I think he actually stepped out of the lab to join us by phone. Hi, Dr. Shapiro.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. And when we last talked to you, we were still in the midst of a drought in the West, but you had just begun to see a spike upward in the sightings of monarchs. So what's happened since then?
Well, a great deal has happened, and not only involving monarchs. In a nutshell, the drought was very good for the butterfly fauna at low elevations in this part of California. There had been a long-term decline in butterfly populations in this region beginning in 1999, and during the drought, it was reversed, and we saw butterfly populations returning to the levels that had been familiar back in the 70s and 80s. The exception was the things that had actually been lost, because we had some regional extinctions during that decline. At the same time, butterfly populations in the mountains were disastrously impacted by the drought. We saw great declines in both diversity and abundance of butterflies at higher elevations. I can go into what we think are the mechanisms responsible for that. Anyway, that was the situation at the end of the drought a couple of years ago when we had that extremely wet winter. And subsequent to that, we have seen those trends reverse exactly, so that at low elevations, we have seen rapid declines in our butterflies, so that we are now more or less back where we were before the drought. And at high elevations, we have had some recovery, but only limited recovery, from the lows we experienced during the drought. Now, as far as monarchs specifically are concerned, monarchs had their best few years in recent times during the drought, particularly the latter part of the drought. And then they began going downhill again last year, and this year so far is the worst monarch year we have ever seen in California.
Oh, my.
And all of that seems very counterintuitive and surprising, but if you want to pursue it, we can do so, and I'll talk about why we think these things have been going on.
I would like to know some of that, and I want to take one factor out, and that is milkweed, because some people believe it has to do with milkweed, but you've told us before on this program, there has not been a decline in milkweed in California. So I imagine you're going to focus me on climate.
Well, as far as milkweed is concerned, I don't have direct personal evidence bearing on the situation in the Midwest. I know what I read and I know what I hear from colleagues who actually work in the Midwest. We can talk about that if you like. Here in California, the situation is exactly the opposite of what you would get from reading op-ed pieces in the Bee or the New York Times. There is no shortage of milkweed here. There is a shortage of monarchs to use the existing milkweed. As it happens, this year has been the biggest milkweed year perhaps since I've been in California. The plants are very robust and healthy, have put on a huge amount of new growth, and there are no monarchs to breed on them. In fact, I have not seen a wild egg or caterpillar of a monarch this entire calendar year at low elevations. Not one.
This is a powerful crisis. What's going on, Dr. Shapiro?
Well, we have a hypothesis. I probably shouldn't put it out publicly until we have more evidence to test it. I will just say that it may be related to agricultural practices as they were impacted by the drought. But at any rate, whatever is happening with California monarchs, it is plain that the drought did not harm them at all and that milkweed is not a critical factor. In terms of the overall butterfly faunas, the resurgence of the butterflies at low elevation during the drought is probably related in part to agricultural practices as impacted by the drought, possibly related to some other climate-related things, although the mechanisms are less than obvious. The most likely factor is that during drought, the soil is largely dry, there's a lack of fog, there's a lack of high humidity at low elevations. Now, during the winter here in the Central Valley, most butterfly species overwinter near or in the upper layers of the soil, right at ground level. And that is, in a wet year, an extremely moist environment, and is relatively warm because of the cloud cover. In a dry year, there's much less moisture, and the nights tend to be colder because there's good radiational cooling in the absence of low cloud and fog. The overall impact of that seems to be that in warm, wet years, there's a lot of disease caused by bacteria and fungi among overwintering stages at ground level, while in dry years, things are much more favorable for overwinter survival. So we think that's a significant factor. Another thing is that in drought years, flight activity begins earlier in the year, which means that the species has more time to build up its population numbers in successive generations during the summer. So we think those two things interacted to contribute to the increase in butterfly abundance and diversity during the drought. When those conditions were reversed a couple of winters ago, that immediately reversed those impacts, and we see that reflected in the population behavior since.
So with that, you did see changes then in the breeding patterns.
Oh, yeah, definitely so. Now, we've been keeping track of what we call the first flight date, the first date when a species as an adult is observed during the season, going all the way back to 1972 for about 22 species here in the valley. We started out tracking more species, but a few of them went regionally extinct over that period. And we have seen a progressive earlier and earlier tendency in flight, and that was accelerated significantly during the drought. So that means that the butterfly flight season tends to be longer than it used to be. And in most cases, that means there's more time to build up population numbers. But there are exceptions. The exceptions involve species that attempt to have an additional generation in the fall, and it's really too late to do it, with the result that that generation fails, and you have a lot of mortality, and that will knock the populations down.
You're listening to Dr. Art Shapiro. He is a distinguished professor of evolution and ecology and a zoologist in the Ag Experiment Station at UC Davis. He's been teaching since 1971. He's been observing butterflies since almost that long. And on Tuesday, September 11th at 6:30, he's giving a free public lecture at the Sierra College Nevada County campus. His lecture is titled California Butterflies and Climate Change, Lessons from a 45-Year Data Set. The big arc of 45 years then in terms of climate change, I think even your entire presentation won't be a summary to what you must know, but can you condense that even further for me to the very short version of a summary over your 45-plus years?
Well, we have seen a lot of declines in butterfly richness and abundance. At low elevations, they seem to be more related to land use patterns and habitat loss rather than to climate. In the mountains, however, where there has been much less change in habitat abundance and distribution, we see climate as the overriding factor, and we see a progressive movement of species upslope to higher elevations, tracking the warmer temperatures as they move upslope.
So my earlier reaction was very unscientific and partly emotional when I called this a crisis. What would you call the point we're at right now in terms of that broad, multi-decade perspective?
Well, we have very, very few long-term monitoring data sets of anything that we can use to understand biological responses to climate change. That's why a data set like ours is so valuable. There are so few of them. Most of the analyses that have been done involve widely separated data points. Like there is a famous study being conducted at Berkeley in which they are redoing a mammal survey of the Sierra Nevada 100 years later, going to the exact same places and using the same techniques. But that gives you two data points 100 years apart, and you don't know what happened in between, right?
Right.
What we have is a continuous record for these sites, some of them going all the way back to the early 1970s, and the newest of the sites, the ones that were started latest, we still have more than 25 years of data. So that enables us to use statistical methods to try to get a handle on what in the environment is having the biggest impacts and the critical impacts in population behavior and population abundance. And we can then translate that information into attempts at projecting future impacts of climate change under various scenarios, and that's what we do.
We haven't used the word fire. Is there an impact on the butterfly populations because of the mega fires we've been experiencing?
Well, obviously there is locally. Obviously, butterflies and their early stages and their host plants and their resources are flammable, and they do go up in smoke. On the other hand, I've been getting a lot of inquiries from the general public and from the media about whether butterfly declines, and specifically monarch declines, are related to the fires, and my answer is almost certainly not. The phenomena that we're observing are too large scale, and they began before the recent mega fires. So we will have to keep track of local situations to see what the consequences of fire are, but in terms of the large-scale patterns, the fires are a recent addition to a complex situation.
I think we've posted a photo on our website of a blue and white speckled alpine butterfly. Will you say something about that butterfly and just the alpine butterflies in general?
Well, I don't know what the picture is. I don't recall having seen it. But the alpine situation is perhaps the most critical because the species that are adapted to the highest elevation conditions have nowhere to go as the climate warms. They're already at the highest point on the landscape. And in order to disperse to a higher mountain, they would have to go a tremendous distance through hostile, warm, lowland territory. Okay?
Okay.
So the species that are dependent on very high altitude resources, many of which are leftovers from the Ice Age, they're what we call relics. So they have managed to hang on in the most extreme environments, which is the environment to which they are adapted. They are probably facing extinction, at least local and regional and perhaps global.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Shapiro, I need more time with you.
You may have it whenever you please.
Okay.
I'm here.
I'm going to take you up on that. For now, I'll let you get back to the lab. But thank you so much for these ongoing conversations. And I think what you've said today is, at the very least, startling. So we'll digest that. We'll post more information on our website. And we'll invite again people to your free talk next Tuesday up in Grass Valley. Thank you, Dr. Shapiro.
Okay, and all of you who are listening, please do come out and be prepared to ask questions.
Okay, thanks again.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Tuesday, September 11th at the Sierra College County Campus in Grass Valley. And again, it will be at 6:30. It is free and open to the public. There's more at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Artist and photographer Melissa Uroff will open a solo show tomorrow at the Wall Public Market in downtown Sacramento. The show is titled Portrait of a Delusional Woman. Melissa paints photos of artists and musicians. She places them in surreal, melancholy settings and has elements of fantasy. Her work is beautiful. We posted some of it on our website. She's also the founder and editor-in-chief of Tube Magazine. Hi, it's great to have you in the studio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Will you say more about the materials you work with and the type of art you're doing?
Sure. I am trained as a photographer. And I love to mix mediums. So when photography went digital instead of darkroom, it kind of felt like it lost a little bit. Like I lost the love for it a little bit. So though I work in digital, I also work in film. And I like to use a lot of historical processes for my photography. And then on top of that, Once they're printed, I paint on top of them and collage images into them, both using digital and like by hand, and just kind of use every medium that I could get my hands on and put it all into one piece.
So what's in this solo show?
The solo show is painted photos. So they're printed as photos and then painted on top of local creatives. So musicians and artists, and all of them are women.
I think I remember you were working on a David Bowie show.
I did.
At the time that he passed, and it was inspired by his song Life on Mars.
It was.
Right? So you like theme shows, but I do want to explore the fact that creating art and the way you work has become a little more difficult with another credential that you now have to your name.
Yes.
And that is being a mom, right?
That is very true. I have a 1.5-year-old, and I love her to pieces, but she makes things a little bit more difficult.
When you walked in here, you said, sorry, I was up late. But I think a lot of creative types, once the day gets more full of that kind of mundane adult work, and especially parenting is in that category,
sure.
you need to sort of sequester yourself away in those late, quiet hours of the night to really get creative thinking space.
That's true. I did that prior to being a mom. I would be in the studio until 3 or 4 in the morning and watch the sunrise pretty often, but now it's a little bit more of a necessity. I do bring her into the studio, and she goes on photo shoots with me, and we paint and create together, but there's a lot of, Mama, try this. You know, she wants me to help her with hers instead of me being able to solely focus on what I'm doing. So,
what happens in the art world when an artist, and a woman in particular with a youngster, goes through that transition of being able to be your solo self and then being a divided person? And I don't say that in a bad way at all. It's just that it's a real transition. I hear it from writers, too.
Sure. I don't take that as a bad thing at all. It's been interesting. I thought for some reason that I would just have a baby and then everything would go back to normal, like somebody else could hold her. Mm-hmm. but that's not really the case. Being an artist is very selfish. It's a lot of time on your own, and you have to have a certain amount of being self-absorbed. I don't know if that makes sense, in order to want to make something and have people look at it. And for me, creating is not really an option. There is no other option. That is the option for me. So in order to make that with a little person, there's been some adjustments. I work a lot more at home. I'm up really late at night and then up again really early. I'm kind of tired, but I was tired before having a baby too, you know.
Right.
There's a little bit of a transition, but it's doable. It's just takes a little bit more work.
Is it a subject that's talked about? Are you getting guidance from other people who have been there, and not just moms, but dads too?
I know a lot of single dad artists, and I do have some lady friends who are creative that are mothers, and it's different for everybody, but it does fall by the wayside for a lot of people because raising somebody takes a lot of work, and you don't really have so much time for yourself, I guess. But, you know, I had a friend tell me, you just take a year off and then you'll find times to paint. And that's true. You do just kind of go a little slower for a while. And then if you slow down completely, though, you'll stop. So you have to just keep moving.
I said the word melancholy, mm-hmm, about the show. So what is the thread of sadness that runs, or blueness that runs through it?
Being a mom is kind of lonely. And being an artist is kind of lonely, too. And like I said, I'm working out of my home. We lost our studios about a year and a half ago. And the entire studio that I was at, all the artists ended up moving out of there.
Was that because of a lease situation?
It was a couple different things. I was at the Panama Art Factory. We were burglarized. And then shortly after that, the city came in and closed the place down. Mm-hmm. So I left shortly after being burglarized. And then everybody else left a couple months later because it didn't stay open. So I've been working out of home, which is kind of lonely. You wake up in the morning and you start painting, and there could be days where I don't really see anyone. Mm-hmm. I have a husband and he lives there, but he works on the railroad, so he's gone pretty often. So that's kind of part of the sadness of the show, is a lot of ladies by themselves in odd, surreal settings, because a lot of people think that you must be in a fantasy land to work in a creative field. And I've had people even mention that my job is not a job, that it's a hobby. And I have to remind them that just because I like my job doesn't make it a hobby. It's still work. And it's still, you have to dedicate time and hours and, you know, really put a lot into it.
This is a great reason to invite people to your reception. Come visit with you. come meet Melissa. Come talk about art and creative aspirations and parenting and balancing life.
Thank you.
The reception is tomorrow night from 6 to 8.
It is.
At Wall Public Market, which is at 1104 R Street. And then you can also see the show. And I think the discussion about the fellow artists and musicians who are in the portraits will be very lively, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have some great gals. Dog Party is featured, Destroy Boys, a lot of young creatives, visual artists. Heather Uroff is my sister, also an artist. She's in there, too.
A bit about Tube Magazine. Why a magazine?
We've been at it for about 5 years now, and we have printed. We're online a lot, and then we print also. We're on our 9th issue right now. And we're ran by artists and musicians, all on a volunteer basis. And I think that it's a different approach when it's people that are in the creative field that are creating something about their creative peers or idols. We started with the thought that there was so much happening in Sacramento that if everybody knew what was going on here, that they would stop leaving. Because it seems that as soon as somebody gets a little bit of fame, they take off to L.A. or to New York. So having them stick around or having people know what was going on was a big deal. But Sacramento's changed since we started and is very full. And we just keep highlighting that.
Well, it's great to meet you and have you in the studio. And I do hope people engage with you tomorrow night and through the course of this show.
Thanks.
In your work. And Tube, I'll say, is a print and online magazine. And there are classes that are available and links to other resources.
Yeah, so we do themed art and music shows also. The David Bowie show was one of those that I curated. And we do a lot of DIY classes. They slow down a little bit since the child, but she's getting older, so things are starting to pick back up.
Well, again, this is Melissa Uroff. The solo show is titled Portrait of a Delusional Woman. It opens with that reception tomorrow night at Wall Public Market in downtown Sacramento. Congratulations. Keep going.
Thank you.
Keep going. That's probably the most important thing, right?
Thank you, yes.
Just to keep going. It's great to meet you, Melissa.
Good to meet you as well.
There's more, and you can see some of Melissa's art and photography at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The Nell and Jim Band are just back from performing in France, and they're performing at the Harris Center tomorrow night at Stage 3. The band is Nell Robinson, Jim Nunnally. We also have with us Rob Reich. He's here, and Jim Kerwin. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, so John Arkin is the one who's missing.
We think he may be sleeping in. Yeah.
Well, traffic was a real challenge today, and we were very excited to have you perform live, and I'm just going to say from the get-go that we're going to chat a little bit, but we're going to record that performance after the show.
Thank you so much.
Can find it on the air, right?
That'd be great.
Okay, so how is France, and how's the recording of yet another new album going?
Wow. Well, how about I'll talk about France. This is Nell, obviously. And we were invited to go to a wonderful bluegrass festival in the French Alps, in a beautiful little town called La Roche. And so we had two performances there. We ran into lots of old friends, both from the U.S. and also from Europe, that we'd made in some of our travels. And it was fun because we actually got a chance to translate one of our new songs partially into French and sing it to the audience in French. So it was just fun and an adventure, and Absolutely beautiful. And also very hot.
Oh, you were there for the heat wave.
In the heat wave.
Wow.
Yes.
By the way, the new album, is it titled Steel?
It is.
Yes.
So you're going to record the title track after the show for us?
Yes.
Terrific. What else about playing on the road and having audiences outside the country watch you live?
Well, I think one of the challenges is whether or not you feel like you're coming across or they're understanding you. So we were in France, and sometimes it's, you have this feeling that they don't understand you, but most of the countries understand English. So you feel like, oh, well, when you're around town and stuff like that and you, people are speaking French, you think, oh, no, they're not going to really understand you. But most people in Europe do understand English, even though they may not speak it because it's not their first language. They do understand it. So I found that that was a challenge. And just in speaking to the audience in the patter in between songs, what you usually use is your stage show, you wonder if it's coming across because the response is a little bit different,
right?
You know?
Music, of course, just the sound of the music would be universal. But how was the audience for your bluegrass folk sound?
Oh, they love that. Was a that festival was a bluegrass festival.
And it
was
one of the biggest. So they came there for it.
Yeah.
And was the full band there?
Yes.
Jim, Rob,
everybody.
Yeah.
And some of us have. Jim Nunnally. I'm Jim Kerwin speaking.
Jim Dog. That's what we call him.
Well, I'm called Jim Dog because I've worked with David Grisman a lot and Jerry Garcia, and it was interesting to see the people that were promoting the show. We were the first night we were there having dinner, and then. We were asking what each person in the band, what our background was. And as soon as they found out that I worked with Jerry Garcia and in Olden the Way, Olden in the Way is really what put bluegrass on the popular map, which has now been translated over to Europe. So everyone knows those tunes. And I'm, you know, pleased to have had that in my history. So that's kind of, it's becoming a more universal style of music.
I wanted to hear that they also said, oh, you're that Jim, that best string bass player in the country. You're Jim Kerwin.
And he did hear that. We sat at dinner beforehand and people knew Jim Kerwin. They knew Jim Nunnally from all of his 40 years in bluegrass and folk music. And a lot of these folks are meeting Rob Reich for the first time and very, very happy to meet him too. A great accordion player, great keyboard player, and we're enjoying that whole new sound that he's bringing.
How high was the level of expectation stepping in, Rob?
Oh, in this band or going to France, you mean?
How about in life in general with this band and then in the music of the band?
Well, it's interesting being an accordion player and coming into bluegrass where there's not too many accordion players, and so I'm trying to look for role models elsewhere as far as listening to a lot of other instruments like the violin and hearing how they play it and trying to apply that to accordion. So, and then as far as going to France, well, French have a long history with accordion, and that's a funny thing there is when I put the accordion on, people assume I'm French and I feel like I have to kind of represent the country. I almost feel like I'm French when I'm playing the accordion. So it was kind of an interesting thing, but then I couldn't speak French, of course. And I thought it was also interesting how there was some musicians who play bluegrass in France and sing in English, but don't actually know what they're singing. They just learn the syllables.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, you are back here in Northern California with an audience that knows and loves your music. So say that tomorrow night, Harris Center in Folsom. The next night, the Mildred Owen Concert Hall in Pacifica. Then you move on to McLeod, September 14th.
Yes.
In October 5th, you're back here in Sacramento.
That's right, at the Fifth String, which has a new venue. We're so excited to see what they've put together. John Green did that, the owner of the Fifth String, and it sounds like a lovely place.
Well, Jim's got the guitar on his lap, so I'm just going to say that's insight for now. We're going to record much more after the show ends. If you want to play us out for our final minute or so, and again, the Nell and Jim Band, watch for a new album this fall, and there's much more at capradio.org/insight. Thanks for joining us. Okay.